Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show based around ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padraig Reedy, Richard Saunderson, and Rebecca Watson, as well as regular mystery guest presenters.
Little Atoms makes no claims to balance. We actively promote science, freedom of expression, skepticism, and secular humanism. This means we can often end up talking about superstition, religious fundamentalism, censorship, and conspiracy theory.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting. Hi, good evening. Welcome to another edition of Little Atoms. This week with me, Neil Denny, and my guest tonight is Alex Butterworth. Alex Butterworth is a writer, dramatist and a researcher who has worked across a wide range of media. His projects include television drama documentaries, virtual online communities, educational websites for major cultural institutions and action-adventure games. He is the co-author with Ray Lawrence of Pompeii, The Living City, which won the Longmans History Today New Generation Book of the Year Prize. He took a first degree in English at the University of Oxford, holds an MA in Interactive Media from the Royal College of Art, and is currently an Honorary Fellow of the University of Birmingham. Alex's latest book is The World That Never Was, a true story of dreamers, schemers, anarchists and secret agents. Alex, thanks for speaking to Little Atoms tonight.
Pleasure.
We should probably talk about what we mean by anarchism, first of all.
Okay. Well, what do we mean by anarchism? Anarchism, I suppose, by definition, means a state of being without government. And, coming from the Greek, anarchism, without government, without rule. But, I mean, how it became defined through history is kind of part of the subject of the book. You know, it was used during the English Civil War by radical sects and also by others to describe a state of chaos or a state of kind of benign chaos. And during the French Revolution, similarly. But by the time that I'm looking at in the 1870s, people are beginning to claim it as a positive attribute. Proudhon and Bakunin, well, Proudhon particularly, prior to the 1870s, has defined himself as an anarchist. And in the 1870s, there's a lot of discussion with one of the key figures in the book called Élisée Reclus, saying how actually it should be taken back as something that's notorious, but also kind of therefore high profile way of defining what a group of people who previously described themselves as federalists were all about. I mean, its ultimate aim was to usher in a society of human beings, a heaven on earth in which harmonious existence was achieved without coercion or the imposition of distant authority, as I write in the book, but rather arose out of each individual's enlightened recognition of their mutual respect and dependency. It was an absolute political principle, founded on the Enlightenment idea of the perfectibility of man, and arguably, therefore, fatally flawed in such an absolute form.
One of the first instances that we see in the book, which I'd like to sort of explore in some detail, is the Paris Commune of 1870-1871. So let's talk about what happened there.
Well, you've got to look at what happened before that. That France had been in a state of kind of semi benign despotism under Napoleon III and the Second Empire, who, for various kind of reasons of trying to retain internal political control, staged an invasion, a very ill advised invasion of Germany, just at the point when Bismarck was pulling Germany together, and the Franco-Prussian War, as it became known, turned against him. Paris was besieged through the very hard winter of 1870. And during that time, the kind of radical groups that had been active in the red areas of Paris, Batignolles and Belleville, started staging the kind of radical clubs that had preceded the revolution of the 18th century, 1789 and latterly. And by that spring, there was, the spring of 1871, there was the beginning of open warfare. There were, kind of insurrections around the Hotel de Ville and so on. And then there was an attempt to reclaim the, effectively a kind of stage managed attempt to seize the guns that Victor Hugo had encouraged the people of Paris to subscribe to buy during the winter for its defence against the Prussians. And then this kind of triggered an absolute insurrection and a withdrawal of government forces with the agreement, effectively, of the the Prussians, who handed over, you know, the siege to them, so that Adolphe Thiers could suppress once and for all what he saw as a, you know, as a kind of boil that needed to be lanced. But as a result, for six kind of dreamy weeks, there was something like a communist utopia where many of the socialist dreams that had been talked about in the clubs of, you know, of female emancipation and nurseries to look after children and those kinds of things, and, you know, collectives and cooperatives running bakeries and restricted working hours, were enacted and became a reality. And the palaces were thrown open. There were great descents on the centre of Paris by the kind of, you know, the poor who had been squeezed out by Haussmann's rebuilding. But it was also in some ways underpinned by violence or the threat of violence. The, you know, the first day saw a crowd brutally murder two generals. And latterly, at the end, in fact, there was a degree of restraint throughout the whole period. But at the end, the Archbishop of Paris and various others who'd been taken hostage were shot. But this only after the beginnings of a terrible massacre that lasted pretty much, you know, a week, the bloody week, when over 20,000 people were butchered by the government forces.
Now, I've always been aware of the Paris Commune and its sort of significance in left-wing history, but I'm so, you know, slightly embarrassed to say that until I read your book, I'd always sort of presumed that it was, you know, a group of people who took over a small area and barricaded a small area of Paris, a few blocks or something. But this was basically, it was, well, they took Paris.
They were given Paris, perhaps. I mean, you know, arguably, it's said that Adolphe Thiers, who'd been prime minister 20 years earlier, when this kind of great circle of forts were built around Paris, supposedly for its defence, but even then it was said, you know, this is so that, you know, so that Paris can be suppressed if it comes to it. And it was almost, I mean, it's been suggested it was almost, you know, kind of an enactment of his long held dream of kind of giving Paris over to the rabble, as he would have seen them for a while, in order to more effectively extirpate them.
All the way through the book, there's talk of really interesting characters that are around in, and are important in all these aspects. And something you've just mentioned already in the description of the Commune was basically how progressive, how ahead of its time it was, particularly in the case of women's rights. Mm. So I'd like to bring in the character of Louise Michel, who is an incredible, incredible person.
No, she is. And you know, remains fascinating throughout her life. You know, becomes known as the Red Virgin of the Commune. And has this kind of uncanny ability to place herself at the centre of events. So, you know, she's there at every major event in the kind of precedes the creation of the Commune. She's there when the guns are, or the attempt is made to seize the guns in Montmartre. She's part of the crowd, although she claims lastly that she stands back from it, that kills the generals. And then she's created in a sense as a kind of modern day Joan of Arc during the period of the Commune. She's there on the barricade, she's there at the defence of the Fort d'Issy at the end, and she is extremely good at presenting her ideas, but also in a way it's self-mythologizing, one suspects. In the case of her presence at the fort with the connivance of her friend Clemenceau, you know, lastly the president. But she's also very outspoken, you know, somehow she survives Bloody Week. I mean, you know, she kind of seems to walk through everything unscathed and defends herself against the tribunal, saying, you know, if you have any courage, you should shoot me because I'm never going to renounce my convictions. In fact, she's transported, but she holds by that and by the oath of, sort of solidarity with the communards throughout her life, and is an implacable foe to the Third Republic for its entire existence in one way or another. And to that sense, is emblematic of what anarchism becomes as it takes up the baton of what the Commune was.
Now, the Commune failed and was, you know, as you said, it was quite viciously suppressed. And I sort of want to move us forward a few years, and I'm sort of interested in the idea of London as being this a sort of hub of expats, you know, revolutionaries and people that were escaping from various things, and everybody will already know that London was, you know, the place where Karl Marx, for instance, was, you know, was based while he was writing. Another interesting thing that comes out of the book is actually how opposed Marx and Engels were to, you know, to a lot of the stuff that was going on. And there's almost a parallel history here of what could have happened if you look at somebody like Bakunin.
Yeah.
If Marxism hadn't have come to the fore, there's like almost a parallel universe history of socialism there.
I mean, it's very much like that. I mean, for most of this period, and for almost all the period, the anarchist federalist side of that kind of debate is weaker. It's always outsmarted by Marx and the very kind of manipulative Engels. But, you know, it's Marx who's there and seizes the opportunity to found the Working Men's International, but Bakunin's there soon afterwards, and he certainly, you know, just arrived really from Siberia, that he's escaped on this kind of, you know, grand kind of escape via the Pacific that is actually then repeated by many of the kind of the other figures in the book, that kind of, you know, global escapade. And I think arrives in London sort of expecting to claim his share of the glory, but is constantly sort of outfoxed over the coming years. The challenge to Marx and Engels was that they saw socialism as being something that, you know, in practical terms, that needed to be cultivated by, you know, sort of centralized authority. And for anarchists throughout, you know, the following half century, it is effectively, you know, the same as kind of Bismarck's Germany. It's this kind of centralizing Teutonic force that's against the romanticization, you know, the romanticizing sort of free individualistic qualities of anarchism espoused in France and you know, and by certain Russians.
This idea of London as being like, you know, a sort of centre of that sort of dissent, and the fact that the, you know, Gladstone, for instance, you know, was quite, you know, forthright in our idea of protecting people. It's, there's a parallel with the 90s before, you know, 9/11, and this idea with this, you know, the horrible sort of Melanie Phillips phrase of London is Stan, the idea that London was, you know, was a hub of various people escaping from various revolutions.
Yeah, I mean, all those kind of current debates have great, you know, echoes and resonances in this period. You know, really throughout the 19th century, you know, London was a haven for international refugees, political refugees. Now, to some extent, I suspect that was kind of, you know, a matter of political convenience to the British government, because often they were their kind of enemies' enemies.
Mm.
But it was also, you know, principled belief in a liberal Britain that wouldn't sort of submit to the same kinds of despotic methods used, you know, on the continent, which was kind of, you know, over there and not like ours. And so, yes, Marx and bigger figures at the time, like Kossuth, were protected, you know, despite attempts by, you know, spies to come and sort of infiltrate them in Soho in the 50s and 60s. And that, you know, pertained really throughout until the 1880s. And there was a great moment of shock in 1881 after the assassination of the Tsar, when Johann Must, who was resident here, you know, kind of wrote and delivered a speech which sort of, you know, was roughly taken as encouraging tyrannicide abroad, and was prosecuted and spent 2 years in prison on a you know, in a case that you know, that was cited recently, you know, in relation to Abu Hamza and his treatment. And so, yeah, no, it's absolutely the case that the same kind of arguments are being played out, and even more so kind of latterly, as the large-scale emigration from Eastern Europe of Jews to the East End, and of course, you know, and to America at the same time, becomes a matter of kind of enormous concern, and the East End becomes seen as this kind of, you know, monstrous kraken that's reaching, you know, that's threatening to kind of reach out and strangle the West End, and, you know, with its kind of, you know, candlelit dinner parties. So, yes.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny, and I'm talking to Alex Butterworth about his book, The World That Never Was. Alex, one of the central themes of the book is this idea that the open nature of anarchism, the, you know, egalitarian beliefs, and this belief that human beings are motivated by altruism, ironically, opens up these movements to infiltration by agent provocateurs. And in some respects, this could also be seen as a sort of repudiation of the very idea of human beings being motivated by altruism.
You mean it can be because there are certain individuals who are prepared to kind of expose the fallacy that certain people can live according to their ideals?
Yeah, absolutely.
Unless everyone's perfect, the notion of the kind of perfectibility of man falls flat on its face. I mean, this is the, you know, it's the paradox that's exposed by anarchism, that in a sense that kind of form of absolute political idealism can only be achieved by kind of reneging on its principles. And so it's, you know, it's a question of how far its promulgators are prepared to go to achieve an ideal. There's a great quote from an anarchist congress in the 1880s where they said, you know, we're anarchists because we can't agree. And there was absolutely that kind of, you know, openness. It was, you know, there was a belief in you know, individualism to the nth, even to the extent that at a certain point, even the evangelists of anarchism, people like Jean Grave, writing in Le Révolte, says, Le Révolte says, if your conscience directs you to be an informant, you know, to prostitute your wife, to steal, then, you know, your conscience has to be trusted. You know, we trust the individual motivation in a sense, and this becomes a great problem and stumbling block during the 1890s, when it seems to me there's a kind of criminalization of anarchism to a certain extent, you know, that people are appropriating it for their own purposes, which I think to any, well, not any, most reasonable people seems too extreme. That expropriation of all kinds and the violence associated with it is justified as a way of sustaining a life in an unjust society, and so, you know, and effectively kind of ripping up the social fabric.
So on the one hand, you've got the anarchist, the activist, the idealist, and it's perfectly easy to see what motivates them, and this idea of, you know, the perfectibility of man and a perfect society is fantastic.
And also the injustice that they see. I mean, it's the same thing that motivates all
socialism.
Yeah. There is
absolutely
extreme injustice.
It's easy to see why they think that. On the other hand, you know, it would be nice to have lots of money, so it's easy to understand what motivates the capitalists, the plutocrats, and you know, the aristocrats who want to protect the status quo. The murky bit in the middle is the interesting bit, and what motivates the spymasters, what motivates the informants.
It is absolutely fascinating, and it's, you know, it's quite impenetrable. I mean, I think, you know, we talked earlier about Louise Michel, and I think that at certain, you know, as her life goes on, I felt that in a way I would like to be more qualified to subject her to a sort of psychological case study in a way, but that's equally the case, if not more so, with the informants. You know, often they're people who have been themselves, you know, really quite dedicated revolutionaries and are turned, you know, like the major figure in the book, the pivotal figure on that side of the equation in the book, who's a Russian called Peter Rechkovsky, you know, who starts out as a sort of, you know, interested member of the radical movement in Russia in the 1870s, and within 4 years has joined a kind of an ultra-reactionary Holy Brotherhood, and becomes the arch manipulator of everything that goes around him, ruthlessly damning anarchists to long terms of imprisonment or worse through his provocateur. And there's perhaps the best insight I think that the book offers into this, and it's one that requires, you know, kind of more study really, but, you know, there's a letter that he wrote to his top spy, top agent effectively, a man who's variously called Heckelman and Landesen and becomes eventually Baron Harting, and he's just staged a great sting operation in Paris in 1890 and flees and goes and is actually holed up in the Grand Hotel in Brighton of all places, and Rechkovsky writes a letter to him in which he plays him in the most sort of nuanced psychological manner. It's a letter that has never been read because it was written, there's only a draft written so illegibly, and I, you know, I got it kind of transcribed by a kind of, you know, by my Russian researcher, you know, letter by letter in order to see it. And it's an exquisite sort of document of psychological manipulation in which he's flattered and coaxed and promised and all these sorts of, a master psychologist, really. So that's how I think you know there's a need for there's a dependency in the case of this agent. You know, he was born a poor Jew in Pinsk, and he wants to become a proper member of society, and, you know, his reward ultimately is that he's baptized at the Berlin embassy with aristocrats as his godparents, arranged by his spy master. You know, he's promoted to a baron, he marries a Belgian aristocrat, and eventually he takes over and heads the Russian Okhrana, the political police. So there are, you know, material rewards, but I think more than that, it's about status and about even just those kind of contingent factors of small betrayed friendships and getting one over on someone who was a youth, you know, was a higher ranking revolutionary, those kind of things.
Another one of these characters that's on the, you know, the dark side of the story is William Melville, who was like the first head of the special branch. And I still like to talk a little bit because it's one of the things that's come out that's sort of separate from the book is that, you know, when you've been researching this, the Metropolitan Police were like quite sort of cagey about letting you get to the archives.
Well, more than cagey, and they have been for a century, really. I mean, there's long been rumoured to be a kind of a black book of the special branch. You know, people who were involved in it at the time said, you know, if we could show you the black book, you'd realise quite how far-reaching and deep-reaching were the tentacles of special branch, in a sense, and you know, how much they did. But these disappeared. They were closed under the 30-year rule initially, and then further closed, it seems, because Melville's son became Solicitor General in Ramsay MacDonald's government. At least that was the excuse. And then they disappeared, and it was said that they'd been pulped in the war effort to various researchers, and I think there were other excuses given. And then eventually they resurfaced in 2000 for a serving special branch officer who wanted to do a doctoral thesis. Somehow they were, you know, who knows, discovered in a dusty corner, supposedly. I think we have to assume that they had been held summer by the commissioner's librarian. And he wrote his thesis, you know, taking a particular view on the policing of Fenianism. But then access to them was severely restricted. There was a requirement that forms were signed, that you would reveal nothing. I thought that was ludicrous, and so appealed under the Freedom of Information Act. And it took 4 years in all. Ultimately, after being repeatedly thwarted themselves, the Information Commissioner ruled in my favour and sort of effectively kind of reprimanded Special Branch for its obstructionism. But then they took it to a tribunal, and the tribunal ruled that every name in these documents, in fact, not one book, but three or four or five, and three big books, and then a couple of others, was redacted. And so, you know, one can reconstruct what's going on to a certain extent if you're familiar with the, you know, with kind of the structure of the information. But it's a tough job. And it's hard really to know why. I think it's, you know, I think it has to be to do with a culture of secrecy as much as anything.
Yeah, I mean, all these people are dead now. You know, they're not protecting anyone. So it's some sort of power game, isn't it? Just this, like,
yeah, I think so. I mean, the one justification that I think, you know, has some legitimacy is a universal and, you know, perpetual undertaking to preserve the rights, to preserve the anonymity of informants. And there were informants' names in there, but it would have been easy to redact them. In my original submission to see the files, I undertook not to reveal the name of informants if I was allowed to see it. And so there has to be discretion around that. And I think it's an interesting question at what point, you know, that becomes a redundant argument. At three generations, you know, can their children's children really, or their children's children's children really, really be emotionally or psychologically scarred by it, as the restrictions, the exemptions for the Freedom of Information Act would require?
You know, and interestingly, you know, the end of the Cold War and, like, the fall of the Berlin Wall has seen various documentaries made and various archives revealed, where, you know, all the East German files of it, people can go in and find themselves in the files of the Stasi. And
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah. It seems odd. There's been a lot of rich material for me, archival material for me to research. The Ekrana archive after the Russian Revolution was taken to the Hoover Institute, where the CIA kind of scoured and then eventually made it public. In France, the archives, all the agents' surveillance reports and informants' reports in the Prefecture of Police are available in these kind of huge stacks of cartons. And I think you just have to assume that actually what this is about is continuity against rupture of some kind in the politics of a country. You know, that the French, you know, we're now in the Third Republic is some way back. You know, Russia has effectively undergone two revolutions since these, you know, but there is a strong continuity. Special Branch has recently changed its name, but no more than that. And I think there has to be something too around this kind of foundation myth of benign policing, because there was great resistance at the time to any idea of a political police force, and I think that's probably still the case in a sense.
We're running out of time, but just very quickly to finish off, there's at the very start of the book, you talk about the way that this late 19th century fight against these anarchists was presented as being something akin to a sort of first worldwide war on terror, which obviously, you know, we are still supposedly in now. So let's talk about some of the parallels. I mean, what parallels do you see now in the way that the fight against, you know, for want of a better word, Al-Qaeda has been conducted?
I don't want to draw the parallels too far, because, I mean, I wouldn't want to suggest that, you know, in the present day there is the kind of degree of nefarious activity that's going on that I believe was going on in the 1890s, you know, where there was systematic provocation, and, you know, and it was really, you know, orchestrated by Rajkovsky as a means to a kind of geopolitical end. It was to do with his manipulation of Western governments to try to bring about alliances and so on, and to, you know, create his own personal increase his own personal standing. But, you know, I mean, he himself was organizing international anti-anarchist congresses and inflating the danger, inflating the challenge extremely. And I think there has to be an element of that. Of course, now, the kinds of threats that were imagined in the fantastical literature of the time, you know, literature encouraged as propaganda by the police, of megalomaniacs hell-bent on destruction on a large scale, are realistic. I suppose that's kind of fundamentally the difference. I mean, there has to be, there is a fear of that. But I think that it's also, we also see that in the 1890s, effectively, anarchist terrorism, that first wave, burns itself out. And it's the more repressive measures that encourage it for a period of years. And then when the public become kind of weary of that process, it's kind of exhausted.
we've been talking to Alex Butterworth about his book, The World That Never Was, which is out now from Bodley Head. Alex, thanks for speaking to us tonight.
Great pleasure.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests on our website at littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.